Everybody, welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugat and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Michael Seidlinger, author of Anybody Home, published by Clash Books.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a drink while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we are drinking A Bullet to the Brain, inspired by Michael's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Michael J. Seidlinger is the Filipino-American author of Anybody Home, Clash Books, Scream, Bloomsbury Object Lesson Series, and other books. He has written for, among others, Wired, BuzzFeed, Thrillist, Goodreads, The Observer, Polygon, The Believer, and Publishers Weekly. He teaches at Portland State University and has led workshops at Catapult, Kettle Pond Writers Conference, and Sarah Lawrence. He is represented by Lane Haymont at the Tobias Literary Agency.
Anybody Home is the story of a seasoned invader with multiple home invasions under their belt who recounts their dark victories while offering tutelage to a new generation of ambitious home invaders eager to make their mark on the annals of criminal history. From initial canvassing to home entry, the reader is complicit in every strangling and shattered window. The fear is inescapable. Examining the sanctuary of the home and one of the horror genre's most frightening tropes, Anybody Home points the camera lens onto the quiet suburbs and its unsuspecting abodes, any of which are potential stages for an invader ambitious enough to make it to the scene of the next big crime sensation. Who knows? Their performance just might make it to the silver screen.
How are you doing today, Michael?
Doing all right. It's a nice kind of sunny afternoon. So sunny Sunday afternoon, actually. So it's a perfect time to kind of like be lazy, but at the same time, I'd also kind of guilt myself into getting something writing related done today. So
that sounds great.
That's great. Yeah. Well, we're very much looking forward to talking with you about your work and having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you
Absolutely.
Enjoy giving live readings?
It depends on the book, but I mean, like I've done so many now that to preface it, I would say you never get used to it, at least for me. Like I'm always going to get a little nervous before I read, but it's almost like once you start reading and you read, especially in front of an audience, there's like this magical thing that happens where even if they're not vibing with it, you can still vibe with them anyway. There's something really special about that. After, I don't know, I mean, who knows how many I've done at this point, like hundreds. I feel like at around, you know, somewhere between the first and the 500th reading, you start to find a groove and you understand that dichotomy between audience and reader. And even though there's still some butterflies and whatnot as one walks up onto this proverbial stage or whatever, it's kind of exciting and exhilarating when you actually finally start reading, especially like live in front of an audience. I actually missed that a lot from during COVID when we were all locked down and just doing digital stuff. And then finally going back to in-person readings. Oh man, it was like night and day. I'm like, oh, so I guess I don't hate live readings as much as I thought I did. This is actually pretty good. This is good. It's like there's an interesting connection between the two of us, or not two of us, you know, like the audience and the reader. So yeah, no, I feel like there's real value to it. And I actually enjoy the nerves. I enjoy, it kind of makes you feel alive a little bit. You're like, oh shit, okay, I'm putting myself out of a comfort zone for 8 to 12 minutes. And I'm going to share some writing, you know, some stuff. Audience.
Yeah, you're right though. The Zoom versus the live, even just I teach and teaching on Zoom versus live and just getting that live reaction, it's totally different. It really makes it a different experience.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, I'm curious actually, because I don't know if you know this or not, but we feature a lot of different authors here and some of them are debut and some of them are old school and long time multiple book authors and that sort of thing. But when you were talking about how many readings you've given, I'm curious, I have to ask a follow up.
Yeah,
because I find that what I choose to read from the books has completely changed as a result of giving so many live readings. How do you feel like your relationship is between what you choose? Because I feel like I now pick pieces that I think end on a hook because I want them to buy the book.
Absolutely.
Whereas before I wanted to read like a self-contained piece. Is there any strategies that you think you've developed?
Self-contained piece for sure. I tend to write long form so that, you know, novels, I don't really have a lot of short stories. Actually, I don't even think I've ever published a short story now that I think of it. So because of that, I approach every single work, every single novel that I may be reading from with sort of like this overarching thing where like, okay, I need to find something that captures what this book is about, gives a taste, but at the same rate, doesn't require me to be like, oh, at the beginning, you know, the intro basically to go on and on about, this is what you need to know, guys, before we get into this reading. Let me give you a good 15 minute explanation of the entire plot. I've done that a couple of times and it really like nukes and nullifies a reading. I've learned the hard way that best way is to just go in with a self-contained excerpt, go in with a nice short intro. If you want to say thank you to the people that organized it, that's cool. But honestly, they know that you're there and you're grateful to be there. So it's really like quick intro, really a punctuated excerpt from the novel, and then that's it. Just say thank you and walk off stage. And like with the actual excerpts, I will actually go in and read it aloud to myself aloud a couple of times and find certain words and phrases that just don't translate as well live, or even things like, oh, I might trip on that word. I'm looking at my reading copy for anybody home right now. The excerpt that I'm going to read later, there are actual full paragraphs that I crossed out from this excerpt because wow. I just realized like this doesn't need to happen in this for the pacing of the actual reading to little thing tripping over words or whatever. Those kinds of things I notify or like I find and identify really quickly when I don't even practice reading so much. It's just like going through it, right? Trying to like really identify and iron out the live excerpt reading version of that particular passage. So it's a lot of that. It's a lot of getting to a point where I know that it'll move smoothly. And for me, a perfect reading is 5 to 8 minutes. So like somewhere around there. And yeah, boom, done. You know?
Yeah. So interesting. So Michael, what was the origin idea for this book and what kind of research did you do for it?
So very little, it's kind of presumptuous to say, but it's kind of true. Like I'm very, I guess, desensitized in the modern day, like very little scares me, but home invasions, especially now that I live in a house by myself for the first time ever, which is great, but also like home invasion shit. Home invasions, they continue to be one of the only things that that's truly frightening. And I really think it's because the home, the house that we live in, we create this safe space, the space where we can like unwind and just be ourselves. And ideally, like, you know, like you don't have to worry about whether or not someone's going to jimmy open that door or that window at 3:30 a.m. while you're fast asleep, or is hiding in an air duct or like in some crawl space in your house while you're just busy here writing your book, whatever. All of that really always frightened me. So anybody home sort of started on the nugget of an idea of trying to explore that with almost like a Funny Games, Michael Haneke, that German film that came out in the early 90s, where he used film to break the fourth wall to explore the nature of why we watch the things that we watch. I wanted to do that, but more so in the sense of a book that teaches you as much as it makes you complicit to the actual crime that's happening. So as you're turning the pages, you're essentially complicit to the invasion that's happening, but you're also compelled, ideally, you know, if I've succeeded as a writer, you're compelled to keep flipping the pages, keep going. And one of the main reasons was to explore how and why we gravitate to such things. So it was like a twin aspect of those two main ideas. And then in terms of research, it was a lot of, right before I started actually writing the book, I did a lot of granular research going around and looking up crime reports and stuff online, which it's all there. It was, I was so surprised at how many home invasions happen but are never really reported in the media. And I realized shortly the reason why is because it's not exactly something that's worth sensationalizing unless it's like a Manson murder kind of thing. Media likes stuff that's essentially going to attract rather than repel, and home invasions repel. They're really gross, power-hungry ones where people go in just to torment. Those things, they're reported on criminal records, obviously, and that's all. It all happens, and happens frequently, but you don't hear about it in the news because it's just not good fodder for views and whatever. So I did a lot of that, and back when I was homeless, you know, my early 20s, I was running in a bad crew of people that were equally desperate as me, and we cased houses. We never actually broke in, but a lot of what happens in the early part of the book is stuff that I've done, impersonating a postal employee, leaving packages around the exterior of a house to see how long it takes for someone to notice, seeing a security system to see if they actually have it or if they just bought a little decal and put it on their windows. You'll be surprised how many people just buy those things and never actually.
I bet. I think there's probably a lot of people that do that.
Yeah. Or they have the security system, but they get lazy and they forget to always arm it. People tend to only arm it at night, which leads to the main invasion, the actual setup to be done during the day, which is kind of funny because people can walk right in when you're essentially, you just lock that door or whatever, or you just leave the house for a little bit. That's perfect time for someone to come in. Anyway, so like I did a lot of that during my homeless years. Thankfully, I never actually went through with it because imagine if I did, me and the crew would have gotten caught and I wouldn't be here today. I'd be a felon. I would have done prison time and who the hell knows what else would have happened to me. But yeah, that's really where the book kind of stuck. That by the time I actually started writing this book, though, it had been so long that had gestated in the back of my mind as lived experience or whatever. And I guess it just helped inform that section of the book. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And that's such an interesting background to come from too, because it gives maybe even a little more realism to the text if you feel like you actually have a working knowledge of home invasion.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Although I'm very glad that you...
As am I.
Heavily into writing, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's my question for you. It sounds to me like your writing practice is as much as possible at whatever cafe you can be at and for a sustained length, but I could be wrong. What do you feel like is creating your writing practice and schedule? And also, just because this book felt a little meta to me, and also it always feels just a little experimental sometimes when I'm reading some of your work, what's your favorite experimental literary work? And do you think there are rules to writing experimental literary work that you follow while you're writing?
Well, I'll start from the last question, and you may have to remind me the previous ones because I think those were three.
Yeah, it gets a little bit.
Yeah, I think that was three. So I will say that my favorite literary work, I mean, it used to be House of Leaves by Mark Z.
Yeah.
But over time, I feel like as we mature and evolve as creators, as writers, and become more confident with our craft and just find our voice and all that stuff, we grow out of things. So in the past, I'd always say House of Leaves. I even wrote a nonfiction book that's part of the IG Publishing Bookmarked series of books where the author writes about a book that was very inspiring and changed their lives. And I did House of Leaves. I know Brian Evanson did Raymond Carver. What we talk about when we talk about crap, I'm butchering that. Well, you know what I mean. That book, the big famous. Yeah. So like nowadays,
I don't know. Collection, or was it called What We Talk About When We Talk About Love? Some kind of collection. Just out of curiosity.
It was, I don't know why I'm spacing out the actual title because it's such a memorable title. But yeah, it's that one that everyone talks about and has become sort of Carver's big one, right? Like the one that everyone talks about. But nowadays, I don't even know if I have one. I think it's more just a summation of what innovation and experimentation is on the page. Like in recent times, like last 5-10 years, or no, 5 years, I should say, I think I shifted more from experimental on like the surface, so like sentence level and structural level, to narrative experimentation, where it's more like the way I see it is like I'm maybe a couple of layers deeper into the actual narrative now, where I'm finding interest in terms of experimentation and innovation. Fun fact about Anybody at Home, I actually wrote that in 2015. So it's a relic in my mind.
Oh, yeah.
It came out last year. Right. That's how also it shows the disconnect between publishing and writing. They're two completely different separate things. So like by the time this book got published, it'd been what, 6-7 years? I don't know. I suck at math. But 2015, I finished that in 2015. I wasn't even living in New York yet. I was living in Baltimore, Maryland, Baltimore City, Maryland. It's like a lifetime ago. So like you see a lot of experimentation on like a surface level there, as I like to call it, in terms of the actual what it looks like on the page and the short sentences, the sort of first second person thing where I go from first person monologue to second person and back and forth.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I am not interested in stuff like that anymore, but I think over time I've sort of shifted it into like, okay, well, how do you show a scene in a certain way where it's capturing this essence and how do you really go about that? That's where I find my influence nowadays. And so I don't know if I have a text. I think it's just sort of like I continue reading and exploring, and I watch a lot of films too. More experimental, the better. More indie and arty, the better, because they do tend to show on a visual level how they are presenting things, and you can get ideas that way. And then I think what was the first question was like actual process. I'm one of those writers that has to write every day or else I don't feel normal. Like after we do this podcast, I'm going right into my daily writing. And when I say daily writing, it doesn't necessarily need to be like, oh, I'm actually sitting there and writing 1,000 words. Sometimes it's editing. Sometimes it's research session. But I have to do a chunk of work on the current project every day. I find the time. I'll sacrifice social events. I'll sacrifice sleep. I'll sacrifice whatever I need to get that hour or two, sometimes three, sometimes only 30 minutes. It depends. But when I'm actually writing the book itself, I do like at least 1,000 words a day. When I'm in that second draft editing phase, it's usually a span of time and it can vary. It's just whenever I feel like I've done enough for the day, but I have to do something every day. And I just sort of force myself to realize that if I want to really take this seriously. I have to commit to it. And commitment also requires sacrifice. And so,
yeah,
I know I've lost connections with people, what could have been a closer, longer term friendship. But because I say, yeah, I can't hang out today, or can't go to the bar tonight, man. A number of those times, a number of like essentially being the flake or saying you're too busy. You kind of turn people off, right? Pull away. I know I've lost potential friendships because of writing. I know I've been unable to experience certain things. I feel like as a writer, we are never not thinking about what we could be doing in terms of, oh, I'm over here like watching this movie in the movie theater and should be having fun. Yes, I am. But also at the back of my mind, I'm like, I haven't written.
There are so many hours in the day. So if you work, you have things to do for your house. You have things to do with your family. At some point, something's got to give so you can work on writing.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, I've always been that. I think that's also just the way I was raised. Very strict Filipino-American household. And every day, my mom, not in the same exact words, but would pretty much make it very clear that I had to prove to her and the world and all that stuff that I'm worth the breath that I'm taking every day. There was no, yeah, just go play with your toys. No, it was always like, there were always demands to kind of prove oneself to everyone around them that you're actually worth the life that you've been given.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure, but I mean, it has instilled a pretty crazy work ethic in me.
And yeah.
I mean, it's a catch-22 because although it creates that work ethic, it also makes me never satisfied with what I've done. There's always something else, and I've had to make my peace recently with that.
Yeah.
Anybody home, I'm so grateful that it found its readership and it's done really well. But I look back then and I'm like, yeah, I was really grateful about that whole like the tour and like the rollout last year and all that stuff. And now, as one does, specifically me, like, thinking about the next thing, where's that next thing going to land? And what's the next thing for me? And it's fine to think that way. But I think part of it is also, as a writer in general, that doubt and that whatever it is that you can't control, it's really worth making sure that you always second guess and check yourself when you're thinking and you get caught up in the weeds about that stuff. I have no control. We as writers don't have control over where we end up getting published or how a book people respond to that book. We only have control over what's on the page and what we write. And I, on a daily basis, have, especially lately, been really reminding myself about that. Like how, when in doubt, focus on what you can control. What can you control? Your writing, your craft. That's the thing that we carry with us throughout our days.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a question. I was thinking about your characters. I'm curious about your decision to keep your characters nameless and essentially identityless.
Mm-hmm.
The invaders definitely had some personality traits despite their mask and lack of names. And the victims for sure had identities. I got a sense of who they were. And I understood why you did this, but I'm wondering, were you concerned at any point that your readers might have a difficult time connecting with these characters?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was definitely a risk. That was an experimental risk, right? But for what I was trying to achieve there with this sort of neutrality, sort of idea that you could be anybody. And although personality still comes through no matter what, as one is rendering scenes and writing like the story and all that stuff, the idea was sort of, I tried to take a nod from like non-player characters in video games, those NPCs and stuff like that, where they're sort of shells. Like they're only defined as much as they need to be defined in order to move the needle or move the story forward and get the message across. And it was a calculated risk for sure. And I mean, that's one of the criticisms of the book. Some people are just like, I can't keep track of all the people, blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. I knew going in when I was writing it that was an experimental risk that I was willing to take, and I took it. And I knew very well that when you don't actually have names to characters and you can't really give those identifiers, that they can get lost easily.
Did you at one point think, I'm going to try and do a draft, or I'm going to try and play around with giving them names? Or were you like committed from the beginning, I'm not doing that?
I was committed from the beginning. Like when I finally started writing this book, it was a sprint. I wrote it in like, well, I want to say like 2 weeks. And then I spent like a week editing it. And then that was it. And I just kind of, I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know who to show it to. And like, and even the friends, writer friends of mine, I'm like, I don't know. So I dropped it in my little file folder of like unpublished stuff, and it sat there forever. It sat there until actually shortly after lockdown 2020, when I was on a Zoom with Clash Books. They were pitching me something actually, and which was really cool. And I was really humbled by that. And I think then that's where I mentioned Anybody Home, and Christoph, the editor there, was like really intrigued by it and told me to send it to him. Sent it to him. And then like a month later, I'm just scrolling through Twitter, you know, when Twitter was good, right? Yeah, back in the day. Now it's dead now. But yeah, I saw Clash tweet out something like along the lines of like, it's kind of fucked up that when you're reading a home invasion submission, when you're stuck at home. And I was just like, I wonder if that's about me. I didn't really think much of it. And then shortly thereafter, he DM'd me saying, yeah, I'm reading your book. I'd really dig it. Let's do it. If you're down, let's do it. And that's sort of how it came to be. I know that kind of moves away from the question, but like, no, this thing was kind of ready made in the sense of like what I wanted to be when I started writing it.
Yeah, for sure. And something that interests me too is you have a lot of great blurbs that are kind of from people who are connected to horror and that sort of thing too as well. And I was wondering for you, what's your history with kind of the fusion of horror and literary interests? I guess that's the first question. I'll let you.
I think I've always been writing transgressive stuff and psychological horror, but I was never labeled that. And then Clash was like, no, you've always written horror. Like some of my earlier novels, like My Pet Serial Killer and Laughter of Strangers, they're horror. But it's just that I end up like sort of in the indie lit space with presses that just labeled everything that they publish literary fiction or experimental fiction. So I think I was always a horror writer, but never really was marketed as horror. So when I finally was, I guess people are like, oh yeah. Okay. So for a lot of people, like Anybody Home is like, they're the first encounter they have with me as a writer, even though it's my 14th book or something like that. And I don't know if that answers the question, but how I see myself in the space, in the sense that the horror space is great. There's like this general attitude that they care most of all about the writing and books, and they actually read books. Whereas I've encountered, and maybe it's in a sort of joking manner, like a lot of literary circles and literary fiction, although we really appreciate the work and talk about it and talk about craft all the time, I've never, at least my experience, literary readers don't really buy books. And if they do, they don't read them. They'll buy it to support. And I just felt like there were very few readers that were reaching out to me for a lot of my previous books, right? When I was marketed as literary fiction, as wanting to ask questions about the book and all that stuff. But then with Anybody Home, as being marketed as horror, the TikTokers found it and people on Instagram found it. The horror community found it. It was all really like a rush in a way. And I was like, oh, is this what it is like when a book actually is read? I'm like, wait, so I published 13 other books and they were just never read. Okay. I think genre spaces, it's true what they say, that there are people that orbit those spaces that are there for the right reasons, which is as writers to write and then as readers to read. And in literary spaces, I think I'm not bad mouthing literary circles, but I just realized that, oh, so we're the craft people. We're essentially marketing to each other for the most part. And I think that was the hurdle that I experienced along the way, where I'm like, never really getting any readers, but also, you know, being very active in the community. And then it was only around the time that I discovered the horror community that it made me realize that readers are only in certain spaces, generally speaking, and some genres do. It's true what the stereotypical thing is, like that certain, like romance and horror and thrillers, people read, they read.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I don't know, my experience with Comic-Con and also with some cons regarding science fiction and speculative work, those fans are amazing. Like they will buy your book and then they will buy 3 copies of it and they will give it to other people if they really like your book and they'll talk up your book. I love what you're saying about the literary space, because sometimes I think it's almost ego driven that people don't even want to talk up other people's books as much or something, as if it takes away from them.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I know that there's toxicity to every single community, right?
For sure.
But my experience, yeah. I mean, I feel like I've seen a lot of like in literary spaces, people that come from the same MFAs, they always talk each other up, which makes sense. But in recent times, I've seen the literary community, quote unquote, the indie lit community, sort of like silo itself. Like everyone's just sort of in their little small circles. And I'm like, it makes sense. And it's cool in the sense that they kind of found their place, you know, in terms of people like minded writers and stuff like that. But I do wonder like where the readers are. At the end of the day, I think a lot of literary fiction circles tend to be the people working on the craft and thinking about their careers and whatnot. And I've noticed that there is less of a readership across the board with that particular genre. And it's, of course, that's a generalization. So, I mean, I'm not saying in general, this is the case for everyone, but I've seen it. I've seen that like it's almost like we're publishing literary people, like literary, especially in the indie space, we're publishing like our own literary novels to each other, essentially. And like, then,
well, more important than publishing to each other, I think the problem is that you're only advertising to other people who are already in the community. So because there's not that marketing budget, there may not be that distribution. the indie presses may not be offering the right sale margin for the stores. They may not be allowing for returns of the books. So there's not like that huge print run and that small cost to each of the books. Anyway, long story short, I feel like I've thought about this a ton with that too. And I feel like if you're offering me the book I already got sent for free to Blurb, then I'm not the right person for you to be sending advertisements to about the book if the circle of promotion is so small.
Yeah. And I think it's the fact that you already mentioned returns and all that stuff, it says a lot in the sense that, like, you know, you've done your research, you've seen it, you know how this stuff works. I feel like the problem is also a lot of writers just don't know how it works. And so they end up in that situation where they're essentially just marketing to the same people that are writing the same, like not writing the same things as you, but like essentially your peers. And I mean, that's not going to work. You know, that just doesn't work. To be there to support you maybe. And that's cool. But the idea is when you publish a book is to find readers, and some readers may be writers. Yes, but not.
A lot of them are not.
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the lines in your books is, above the cults and the craft, the camera and the performance, it begins and ends with entertainment. We want to be entertained. That's all this is anyway. I really like how in the last part of the novel, you lean into the cult notion and really pull back the curtain on reality TV and society's interest in violence consumption, which is very real and also exacerbated by social media. Do you envision it getting worse, or at some point, do you think people are going to stop and choose not to participate?
That's a good question. I think we're already pretty much there in terms of how bad it is. It's just like constant. I feel like we all are amazed by some of the things that we hear about as a result of social media and like the commodification of thought and personality and human beings in general. I feel like we're getting towards this point with social media where Twitter's dying and the TikTok is under fire for, like, I think they're maybe going to be banned from the US or something. There's always uncertainty. And as a result, we hear about like how the younger generations that are coming into this are finding other ways to connect, whether it be smaller communities on Discord or going back to Tumblr. Or I remember reading some, I'm going to space out like the actual details here, but it was like, I think it was a New York Times article about how there are these teenagers that are refusing technology and they're back to flip phones or like those older phones. And
I read that article and they just like hang out together and read their books. And
yeah, but I feel like that's all commentary on the fact that we're finally getting to this bubbling over point where we're realizing that this thing that was great for a lot of people and maybe was never great for a lot of people is really starting to show how deeply it's kind of messed people up. And as someone who's used to be very much on social media and has also been backing away, like I have no interest in being on any of it anymore. I mean, I am on Instagram just because I feel like it's still good to, like, if there's something I want to announce or something I want to do, you know, it's Instagram stories and a post every once in a while. But like, I think a lot of us writers, particularly writers on social media, we get caught up in this toxic relationship with it where we're like, okay, we're only writers and relevant if we're participating in the discourse on a daily basis and always talking up both our own writing and other people's writings. And we got to be on this thing all the time. We need a million followers and we need all this other stuff. And then how many times have we heard about the stories where like people that do have a crap ton of followers put out a book and they don't sell any books? It really comes down to our relationship with the technology. And although I don't think we need to get rid of it, I just think it's finally into a point where we can't ignore it. And with writers, I'm seeing a lot of people backing away from the toxic areas. People are leaving Twitter. People have left Facebook. Facebook's been in a dead zone forever. And people are kind of readjusting how they, quote unquote, promote their books and work on how to stay in touch with their audience and their readership. But at the end of the day, I think it's about readership. I think it's about getting the work done in readership. And then for writers and technology and social media, it's now's, if you haven't thought about it, now's the time to really think about what your relationship is with this technological platform, because it is clearly messed a lot of people up. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. I know for me, it's so jumped the shark. I'm so over it. And I hate every single one of my social media channels.
Yeah. I'm largely off now. I was a big Twitter person and now I'm hardly ever on it.
Yeah. I still have my account.
Yeah.
I put the lock on just because I'd rather keep the screen name.
Yeah.
Even though I went on there the other day because someone, like a friend of mine, DM'd me. I guess they didn't realize I wasn't on Twitter anymore, or like not active on Twitter anymore. And like, I got a little notification thing. That's actually how I saw your DM to me. I was like, I'm not on here anymore, but
I'm not either, but hey.
Yeah. But anyway, so I went on there and I was like, oh, wow, cool. Either people are, the algorithm has like basically broadcasted that I'm no longer on here because I've lost over 1,000 followers, or people are leaving. Either or, you know, maybe it's both. But I do think writing on the wall for sure for a lot of people. Yeah, I have it on lock and I just don't do anything with it. And I'm just going to stay there. I think we're losing our check mark soon. Fine, who cares?
Well, this is fascinating, but we're looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from the book. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which is custom created for this book.
Today's cocktail is called Bullet to the Brain. The recipe is on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 2 ounces of whiskey, 3 slices of lemon, 1 slice of orange, and 1 ounce of agave. You muddle the lemon and orange slices in a shaker, and after you add whiskey and agave, give it a shake, strain it to a glass with ice, and then you top with a lemon slice. So if you want to make it alcohol-free, you can substitute alcohol-free whiskey or tea. It's really nice too.
Yum. Michael, will you tell us a little bit about whatever you've selected to read for us today?
Well, I'm going to be reading from Anybody Home. It's from the very beginning. It's essentially the passage where the seasoned invader, the one who's done this before, is telling us, the reader, the listeners, about how they made it work for them, their own invasion. The one that entered the main collective consciousness in terms of controversy and fear and whatnot. And there might, if you're, for anyone listening, there's going to be, it's definitely a very blatant reference to one of the movies that really inspired me the most to write this book, which I mentioned earlier. I won't say it now, just for the sake of seeing if anyone listening like identifies it pretty quickly. But yeah, it's towards the beginning. It's before Seasoned Invader starts teaching the reader how to go about creating their own perfect performance.
Excellent. Go ahead, please.
We started early, shortly before dawn. The camera was there even when we weren't. It started on the Outer Banks and panned up and outward. We were dressed in white and made sure to keep everything clean. That's code for gloves. We start on the outskirts of a big lake. The name of the lake, like everything else, we leave unnamed. The authorities do the filling in later. Give them too much and it's just another robbery or break-in, and you don't want that. Camera shot wide across a paved road. I can still picture SUVs and Escalades. Newly washed sedans and sports utility vans driving the speed limit, hulking with them bikes, boats, and other luxury items. We spotted the house on the far eastern bank, expecting it to be the one to begin what would end up lengthening out across 6 houses before the end of the week. Camera narrow in on that driveway, the front gate opening and closing on its own. We walked around the back of the house. It was impressive, really it was. There was privilege in this community. That's something we learned in the months planning before the final pull-off. We learned that for all the tall gates and security systems, the guards and barking dogs at night, it's that level of silence that defines what rural can be. That silence isn't security. Just because those shrubs grow high and the vines cover your windows doesn't mean in the depths of the silence there isn't someone watching. We watched. We stepped inside these homes. We took our time, learning their routines. We weren't going for just another performance, you see. We wanted to create a series of performances. This meant that we had to plan everything, every single invasion, as its own step. We spent at least 8 months just on the setup, the planning. When it finally happened and he was in place, waiting for the first family to arrive, me in the backyard, awaiting the first cue, it was serenity. You see, we almost saw the work, all that planning, play itself out like a perfect take. It felt like a perfect fit, and then the family showed up. There was a daughter, about 11 years of age, and the parents. They drove up the driveway, took their time getting situated, airing out the house, the wife wandering around out front, checking to see that the landscaper had successfully kept flowers and other vegetation in shape. That freshly cut lawn wasn't the husband's doing. We watched a crew arrive and tend to the house's upkeep. 2, actually. One of the employees wasn't as careful as the others. It's how we were able to get inside the house. It's easier than you think. It almost never has to come to actual break-ins or invasive lock picking. Never learned how to pick a lock. Few do. It's easier to figure out the source of the lock door than the lock itself. By the time the daughter was indoors with the husband, worked on fixing the power via the switch box in the basement, the power we extricated an hour before their arrival, he knocked on the door gently. He said what he was supposed to say. Hello, I'm from the house down the road. We were wondering if you have any power. Ours seems to have gone out. From there, it was the wife calling to the husband, who then seemed relieved that it wasn't just their house that suffered from the power outage. By then, he was already inside, and so was I. But I waited until he dropped a picture frame, the glass shattering, distracting the wife, who went into the room I just left, the kitchen, for a dustbin. The husband tended to the broken frame. He did a great job playing the pity case, apologizing profusely. Then I was there, and they both wondered how I got in. We're friends. Brothers, actually. See how I switched it up, making it unbelievable? What better way to let them know that something's wrong than by acting strange? They had already welcomed my partner in performance in. It was up to me to tend to the rest. I asked if they had a pet, maybe a dog. I asked about their daughter. By then, the daughter had been neutralized, tied up and taped upstairs in her bedroom. The wife called for the daughter. The husband ran to fetch her. The wife didn't take much to subdue. She didn't even scream. She was all shivers, which I couldn't stand, so I got him to hold on to her while I followed the husband upstairs. And right around the time, both the husband and the camera panned across a frightened daughter. A daughter that had pissed herself while alone in her room. The basics of the invasion had already begun. A quick strike to the back of the husband's head with a blunt object. In this case, it was one end of the daughter's skateboard, and we could get to work. We tied them to their individual beds. We thought about what we should do. I remember looking around for a better angle, thinking about whether the volume of invaded homes would really be enough. The husband regained consciousness, and we got to talking. He proved to be an easy one to break apart. Talk about his life, career, hobbies, various flings he had on the side, and he'd begin to sob. My partner in performance mentioned that his wife is attractive. I joked about guessing her age. I joked about whether she was in shape. I wasn't joking when I asked the husband, and then he wouldn't tell me. We had to find out a different way. It turned into a game. I brought in the daughter and tied her so that she could run. The daughter forgot about the rope around her ankles. Poor thing. Now that didn't need to happen, did it? Plastic bag over and around the daughter's head got them playing. All throughout, we both looked to the situation, looked for something we could use. We needed to improvise because we were ahead of schedule. Then I said the one thing that defined everything else. Let's play a game. With great effort, they played out various games in order to be untied, led back out in front of the house, and led to believe that they'd have to eat grass if only to see that they aren't above being demeaned. The daughter didn't make it, though. I think we didn't let enough air in the bag. She suffocated on the fifth or sixth tightening of the bag around her neck. It was part of the game. Guess right and the daughter doesn't get hurt. This one moment became one of the more memorable characteristics of our performance, and it didn't end there either. The games continued. From the front yard, we saw the second family, as prototypical as the first, waving to each other, talking about dinner plans and yachts. Shortly after finishing with the husband and wife, we followed the camera over to the next house, the next family. He asked about the power being out. I wandered around back and waved to the husband with his young son, who had been approximately 9 years old, where they were cleaning and maintaining their yacht. I complimented them on the yacht's condition. I told them I was a neighbor, using the same excuse. Power outage. We played games mirroring the first family's set. We made this one last a little longer before moving on, the wife being the last to go, sinking to the bottom of the lake like dead weight. We increased the games with each family until we had the sixth in turmoil, two teenage sons competing for their own lives while we watched. The games were simple. They started out like any little playground game, but quickly mounted to be far more sinister for the camera. You tend to forget the camera. You see that it gets more on record than you ever could. But the fact that it's there seems to satiate the cults. It seems to get as much of the picture as possible. Like, we didn't see how the sons of the sixth family ended their parents' lives in order to conceivably save theirs. We didn't need to see that. We left during the final couple strikes of golf clubs on the cracked skull and shattered jaw of husband and wife. By the time the authorities played their part, one son ran while the other chased after. It became their own little deadly pursuit, a game based around the guilt that they wouldn't be able to lose. The camera captured it long before the one son tackled the other to the ground near a dock and drove his thumbs into both eye sockets. With an injury like that, you don't lose sight. You lose your life. We weren't there, though. Camera captured what needed to be captured. Later, it became just another piece of evidence, the footage for all to see. I'll tell you, though, in those last couple moments when our performance became more than the sum of each individual part, I could see it all. Everything for what it really is. I could see the various roles and the various emotions. I could see the authorities getting the call, marking up each house for their burial. I could see the effect of the events on the private community, causing a drop in property values and a rise in paranoia. I could see popular culture wrapping its mind around the performance. I could see borderline success long before we got an offer. I could see the annals of privacy and personal space shifting and contorting to welcome in a world realer than real. I could see the cults and their members clamoring over the uncensored footage. I could see them going through, like armchair investigators, long before the edited, commercialized version ever makes it onto the screen. I could see the trail of evidence slowly reaching us, and I could see my own concern, worry mounting, if only because it would be more dramatic for it to end with our identities being revealed. Yet, like any other successful performance, we were deemed invaders. I was Invader 1 and my partner performance was Invader 2. Without names established, they couldn't trace back our identities. Without fingerprints or true faces on footage, our likeness is little more than blurred pixels. The authorities couldn't get any closer than recovering the evidence and initial plan for invasion. It was an invasion, and it invaded the collective senses. I could see success in all its conceptual glory, and it's beautiful. You know it is, otherwise you wouldn't be listening. It's truly magical when you think that the only people that could ever identify us are the victims that end up losing their lives and thereby immortalizing our efforts. It's a certain kind of celebrity, one lived behind a number of screens, equally factual and false. We take it because it's celebrity. We take it because of the performance. We take it because it entertains the millions that watch. We take it because it's ours to take. We decided to take it. Now I'm going to ask you, what are you going to decide?
That was excellent. What a good excerpt to read.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, that's the one that I tend to lean to. The other one is later into the book when they're actually kind of messing with the family and stuff like that.
Yeah, such a creepily interesting passage. Can you let us know, do you have any new projects you want to speak to, something you're excited about now? For example, what are you writing today?
I can't say specifics, but okay, something I'm writing right now is for a series. There's a press that publishes books on video games. And I'm writing a book about a specific video game right now. I have a couple other projects that are out on submission, and the audiobook for Anybody Home's coming out in early May.
Cool.
Yeah, there's other stuff happening with that with Anybody Home. Yeah, I can't really say anything specific though, because it's all like what you said earlier in this conversation. Like, you know, there's a lot that I can't control, but there's a lot out there that we'll see what happens. But at the very least, yeah, I'm writing up right now, literally as we end, when we finish talking, I'm going to go back to writing that video game book. I'm deep in it right now, which means a lot of playing that video game, which is, it's like a nice balancing act of having fun playing it, but also realizing I can't spend 3 hours playing this game and not write anything at all.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to new writers?
I think one thing that I wish someone would have told me at the very beginning was to identify and be able to answer the question, why? Why do you write? Why are you writing this? Why are you compelled to write? Why do you continue to pursue the craft of writing? Because I feel like so many writers get lost in the weeds in terms of like, okay, so you need to publish, right? You need to make X amount of money. You need to get like a film made, right? You need to write screenplays. You need to do all this other stuff. You need to be a public speaker. We get lost in the actual career aspects of it so much. So it's almost like the best piece of advice I could give is to be like, at the very start, figure out why you even wanted to start in the first place. And then hold that close. Hold it really close and always remind yourself, this is why I like writing. This is why I decided to write. Because it's a very lonely thing. You know, it's very much like a thing that you have to do on your own for a lot of it. And then when you get to the social aspect of it, so much of it's woven into the publication and all these readings and things like that. So it's a weird career choice. This is also a career choice where you have to balance it with an actual thing that pays the bills, right? It's not like very few of us can actually make ends meet just off of writing.
Yep.
So the odds are stacked against any emerging writer. So I think one of the rays of proverbial light or the things that carry you through is to know why. Why you decide to commit to it and continue working on your craft and go through it no matter the peaks and pitfalls that we hit. It's easy when you're going off of a success, but it's also, it's really a despairing thing to be sort of like in a down moment in your career where you don't know and there's a lot of uncertainty. But if you know why you write and why you continue to write and what you do on that page, no matter how much it might scare you or be intimidating, it will carry you through.
Yeah, that's really great advice and so true, keeping the focus on the why all the time. Well, thank you, Michael. Thanks for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We really enjoyed talking with you and hearing you read from your work.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Our pleasure. And everybody, please order Michael's book, Anybody Home, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary and horror authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time. Thank you.